Welcome to Let's Talk Micro.
Hello, dear audience. Welcome to another episode of Let's Talk Micro. As always, I hope you had a great week. And, of course, you can always find Let's Talk Micro on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, Goodpods. Wherever you listen to podcasts, you can find Let's Talk Micro. As for our social media, I am on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube as Let's Talk Micro, on LinkedIn as Luis Plaza, on X as Let's Talk Micro 1, on YouTube as Let's Talk Micro, and I have an email address which is letstalkmicro@outlook.com. So either via social media or via email, you can reach out with any questions, any feedback. They are always welcome and appreciated. So please go ahead and subscribe to the podcast, download episodes, and if the app allows you to do so, please go ahead and leave a review. Thank you so much for the support. And of course, if you are looking to learn more about antibiotics, please check out www.learnantibiotics.com and the Learn Antibiotics book available on Amazon. These resources include cheat sheets, practice tests, games, and more, and they are being used by thousands of people worldwide and may be helpful for you or your colleagues. Great resources from Dr. Timothy Gauthier, a very passionate pharmacist. Okay, so today's episode is a little bit longer than normal, so it's over 50 minutes, but amazing content. So let me just tell you that if you haven't listened to the previous episode, please go ahead and do so. It was about bone and joint infections. And in the episode, I am joined by Dr. John Gomez Jr. from Hospital del Mar in Barcelona, Spain. And he came to the podcast and he talked about bone and joint infections. He started breaking them down. He talked about different types of bone and joint infections. He talked about organisms seen in this type of infections. He also talked about typical antibiotics use. And of course, sometimes, you know, with some of these infections, you can see biofilms. So he also mentioned some antibiotics that have a good activity against biofilms. All in all, a great episode, so definitely check it out if you haven't already. So let me tell you a little bit about today's episode, and it is about the dengue virus. So maybe you have seen on the news, sometimes, you know, you hear reports of some outbreaks. Maybe you heard about a notice that the CDC issued this past summer regarding Puerto Rico and dengue. So I thought it was a good time to talk about dengue. So in the episode, I am joined by Dr. Rodney Rohde. And those of you that listen to the podcast regularly, or maybe that are active in social media, microbiology, and medical laboratory sciences, you know that Dr. Rohde, he does a lot of publishing. You know, he publishes articles, the explainer articles where he talks about a disease or about an organism. They're always very informative. And he's been a guest before in the podcast. You know, he was in an episode about monkeypox, one about rabies. He joined Andrew Princey in an episode about biofilms. So he's definitely a very welcome and recurring guest in the Let's Talk Micro podcast. So he came in to talk about dengue, breaking it down, right? So he talks about the dengue virus, you know, what type of virus it is, like an RNA. He talks about the family. He talks about, you know, symptoms, lab testing. He even talks about a vaccine. So I think all in all, definitely was a very informative episode. And at the end of the episode, after we explain everything, I ask him about something else that he's doing now. So he publishes, he's a guest on other podcasts, he stays very busy. So now he's doing something new. So stay tuned to find out what it is. So definitely a great episode. Let's go ahead and listen to it. So as I mentioned, when I'm doing this podcast, you know, one of the great things that it gives me the chance to talk to people in the field and have some great conversations. You know, I learn a lot in the process while also educating you, the audience that's listening. And this guest, you know, he's always great. And he's been in the podcast before. He did an episode about monkeypox. He did one about rabies. He was here with Andrew Princey on a biofilms episode. Overall, always great topics. So, you know, when he's here, we're going to talk about something great, and today is no exception. So here with me today, we're going to be talking about the dengue virus. As you know, maybe you see some reports in the news. If you're in the microbiology community, you see some notices like from the CDC. So today we're going to break down the dengue virus, and this guest, you know, he does explainer articles on this type of subjects, you know, which is very informative. So with me today, I have Dr. Rodney Rohde. Dr. Rohde, welcome to Let's Talk Micro.
Thanks so much, Luis. It's always great to be back. And, for your listeners, I hope everybody's out there sharing this podcast with their other microbiology friends and others, right? People in public health and the general public, because certainly we have more and more to talk about in the realm of microbes. So I'm looking forward to talking about dengue today.
And for the listeners, I mentioned this again at the end, but once the episode comes out, there's going to be a link to the article that Dr. Rohde did about dengue, so you can have more information and enjoy it at your own pace. It has been a while since you've been in the podcast. Welcome again, and maybe can we start with you telling the audience a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Sure, thanks. Just kind of briefly, I often talk about myself as a professional hybrid, and that's because the first decade of my career, which was about, 92 to 02, I worked for the Texas Department of Health State Services and the Bureau of Laboratories and Zoonosis Control Division, and it was a fantastic job. I loved everything about it. It was primarily public health, microbiology, and really specifically more in virology. And so I worked with rabies and arboviruses and plague and hantavirus and, all those fun microbes. I got to not only play in the lab with diagnostics, but I also got to go out into the field and do some field work. So I did that for a decade. And then in 2002, I had the opportunity to hop back to my alma mater here at Texas State University. And so I started off as an assistant professor in the medical lab science program. And I've been here 22 years now, which is hard to believe. I became chair in 2013. So I'm starting my 12th year as chair and still conduct research in antibiotic resistance and biofilms and some of the things we've talked about on your show. And I still keep my hand in the public health realm, which is why I do those explainer articles that you talked about. Love talking about public health and clinical micro topics in different ways, including podcast and articles and things like that. So thank you.
Definitely my pleasure. So as you know, like here in Let's Talk Micro, we always like to break things down to the basics. So let's start with an overview of the dengue virus. Can you talk more about it? What family of viruses, if it's an RNA virus and things like that.
Sure. Yeah. Great way to start out. So this virus, dengue virus, is caused by a virus that we know is in the Flaviviridae family. And so for all you closet virologists out there, you know that. But anytime you see that Viridae ending, that's the family level. So Flaviviridae. And then the genus is Flavivirus. And that is where dengue is found. And interestingly enough, within that genus, it's also where we see a yellow fever. Maybe you've heard of yellow fever virus, West Nile. Many people know about that. One maybe not commonly talked about, tick-borne encephalitis virus, Japanese encephalitis virus, Zika, which many people have heard of. And then lastly, hepatitis C, which is kind of interesting because hepatitis C is the only flavivirus that is not vector-borne. And fun fact for your audience, the virus family, the flavivirus family, is named after the yellow fever virus, which comes from the Latin word flavus, which means yellow. So, people sometimes have some appearances, whether it's hepatitis or other types of things can have that type of appearance. So it doesn't fit with every virus in the family, but just some history there for you. It's also an enveloped virus with a non-segmented single-strand positive sense RNA genome. So, viruses, if you know about viruses, you tend to kind of plop them into the DNA side of things or the RNA side. So dengue virus is definitely an RNA virus. And then, as you know, Luis, one of the interesting things about this virus is that there are four distinct genotypes, 1 through 4. And we probably will talk about that a little bit more as we go through it, but they do not have cross immunity. And so it's kind of a peculiar trait of dengue 1, 2, 3, and 4, if you get dengue 1, you will typically develop antibodies, hopefully, to that virus and be able to, overcome it and neutralize it, but it doesn't provide protection against dengue 2, 3, or 4. And so there's some nuances there with the infections that maybe we can talk about later. It's weird because you can have an infection with another serotype and it can be really dangerous depending on what's going on. And then lastly, I know we often kind of mention statistics, so I'll just kind of throw in some big numbers, kind of big picture numbers here. If you look at CDC and World Health Organization and kind of those primary reputable public health sites, a person, as we just mentioned, can be infected multiple times with this virus because of those different serotypes. And then annually, roughly, we estimate about 400 million people, 400 million people are infected by a dengue virus. And if you're curious, and maybe why we're talking about this today and why I wrote the article is 2024 has been a banner year. It seems like every year we have something going on, right, in the public health world. But Brazil is the country with the highest number of cases this year, over 6.3 million suspected dengue cases and about just over 3 million laboratory confirmed. That's followed by Argentina with about a half a million, Paraguay with almost 260,000, and Peru. And just to kind of wrap up here before the next question, the reason this kind of grabbed my attention, Luis, was my wife and I did some traveling this past May. We took a vacation and we went to Italy and to Scotland. And you know, one of the messages that I'll often talk about throughout these types of interviews is, especially Americans, you know, something to keep on your thought list is if you're traveling out of the US, you really should think about where you're going and understand, you know, are you going to need vaccines? Are you going to need some perhaps some antivirals or some type of antibiotic or something to take with you? Because once you get out of certain regions and you go into tropical or subtropical regions, you know, you are going to be more at risk for malaria and dengue and yellow fever and Zika and some of those types of things alongside other pathogens. So just something to keep in mind for your listeners.
Definitely. I'm guessing. I don't know. Have you been to Europe before? Just real side note. I bet it was a great experience. I've been to Italy before, and
Oh my God. Yeah, I highly recommend if you can build in that travel, right? I mean, it's my wife and I are kind of committed to trying to go at least once a year to different places, but you know, COVID kind of messed that up for a little while. But man, it's so much fun to travel, not just from an educational standpoint, but also just from the experiences of other cultures and you know, to understand. Even when I go, it's interesting. I often will try to work in a visit. I visited a hospital in Italy because I just kind of want to see the healthcare system. And so it just, you know, of course, you know, only I might do something like that, but I'm sure other people out there might do things like that. It's just super educational, and I really enjoy meeting different cultures. I'm a professor, you know, so I teach all sorts of people here at Texas State University. And I really like to get to understand some of those cultural norms there.
definitely. As you were talking about the the yellow fever, and something popped into my mind when you said about the yellow and making that connection, why it's like flavivirus and yellow. And it made me think about, and I hadn't thought about this before, but about a flavobacterium, which now it's Crisibacterium, which is yellow. The colonies are yellow.
Yeah, right on. Good call. You know, the other thing I'll throw in here, because I know you've had Dr. Prinzi on your show quite often, one of my good friends and colleagues, just a wonderful expert in these areas, but she wrote a outstanding yellow fever, the history of yellow fever with ASM as well. So we like to write together and do different things. So give that a shot. If you haven't looked at that article, that's a really we both love microbiological history, as I know Luis does. So it's kind of fun sometimes to dive into those stories, and it's pretty phenomenal when you dig into the history of some of these bugs, and you learn about people that, you know, just did some amazing work back in the 1900s or 1800s, and it's like, wow, they did some things before we had all the things we have at our hands now. It's pretty amazing to see.
Yeah, definitely. So shout out to Andrea Princey, which is a listener. You know, show is great. And one thing about with dengue that I am from Puerto Rico, so I remember, and this as I read your article, and you know, I seen the notices and things like that, and I remember growing up, we definitely had a lot of like a PSAs and about dengue, about the water, and some of them people sometimes, you know, make a they kind of jokingly say that we were terrorized by them because they were so serious, and we were little kids seeing these commercials about, you know, children dying from it or things like that. Make sure you protect your family. So those were definitely part of my growing, you know, when I was growing up.
Interesting. I did not know you grew up there. That's interesting to know. I actually haven't been to Puerto Rico. I've been to a lot of other Caribbean areas and places near Puerto Rico, but you know, we'll probably mention it later when we talk about some of the other areas. But yeah, it's interesting. You know, I even bring up rabies, you know, about that, because I guess part of that, those PSAs and public health things, part of it is to it's a fine line, right? You don't want to scare people completely out of their mind, but you do want to make sure people understand that some of these vectors, like a mosquito or a tick or an animal that's not vaccinated for certain things, can be dangerous. But perhaps, hopefully we've gotten better. I'm sure 20, 30 years ago, I can imagine what those public service announcements were like back then.
Yeah, I second that. I think, you know, the late 80s, early 90s, we have come out a long way in being able to communicate better things. So you were talking about vectors. So now let's jump into that, and we all know that, you know, there's some mosquito that's involved in this. So let's talk about transmission.
Yeah. So I'm sure most people understand that when we talk about this genus in general, right, is kind of connected to vector transmission, and certainly dengue is transmitted by a mosquito bite. You can also, within the genus, you could also be dealing with ticks or certain things, but let's focus on dengue right now. And so for dengue, primarily bites have infected female mosquitoes of Aedes aegypti is the primary vector. Other species within Aedes can also transmit, but it's less common. And even the Asian tiger mosquito, which is albopictus, Aedes albopictus, can also, but that first one is the primary vector with that particular disease syndrome. And that's all genotypes. So dengue 1, 2, 3, and 4 are transmitted by Aedes mosquitoes.
So that brings us, and you already touched on this. So you mentioned some places where we've seen higher cases. And I did mention, Puerto Rico growing up, we see it there. Anywhere else that you can talk about? Where is it, you know, commonly seen?
Yeah. We can throw this together a little bit. So dengue is pretty common in places like the Americas, right? So all of the Americas, Africa, the Middle East, Asia, and some of the Pacific Islands. And I know one of the things you'd talked to me about earlier, it's become such an issue in 2024. That even the Centers for Disease Control issued a health advisory that included a public health emergency in Puerto Rico, which is where you said you grew up. And for your audience, if you don't know what that is, the CDC, they have something called the Health Alert Network, H-A-N, and they will every once in a while distribute these. You may have seen these with foodborne outbreaks. It could be, avian influenza, you know, all kind of the hot topics will sometimes pop up, but sometimes it's other things that kind of pop up. And dengue certainly popped up in 2024 for the U.S. and Puerto Rico and places like that, kind of unusual. But it popped up because Puerto Rico, which is a U.S. territory, declared a health emergency. There's about, as of the data that I could see today, about 1,500 cases, which is higher than expected. And also a lot of U.S. travelers, again, thinking about those countries like Argentina, Brazil that we mentioned earlier, almost 750 cases that have been lab confirmed between January 1 and this date is to about July 1st of 2024. So not totally current, but that's about as current as we can get. In the United States, dengue is a nationally notifiable disease. Again, for your listeners in the public health world, these are kind of determined in the rank and order of danger or risk. So, for example, in some instances, when you go to the hospital or your doctor and you have an infection, sometimes, you know, you're going to get diagnosed and you're going to get treated, hopefully, but it's not always nationally reportable. Others are. And so this is one of those. And so six U.S. territories like Puerto Rico, and some of the other closely associated states are classified as areas with frequent or continuous dengue. And so just to name those for you, that's Puerto Rico, American Samoa, the U.S. Virgin Islands, the Federated States of Micronesia, the Republic of Marshall Islands, and the Republic of Palau. And you may have heard of this this year, and you're in Florida, right? So I'm in Texas. And so the three states that we tend to kind of keep an eye on is Florida, Hawaii, and Texas. Doesn't mean it couldn't pop up in Louisiana or, somewhere else, but right now we have seen some sporadic cases, and I know Florida's been reporting a few cases this year too.
Yes, and as you were, you mentioned the health advisory on the Health Alert Network, and with the listeners, and and those of you that listen regularly, we have done some episodes about it. Especially, I did one about a notice they did with some extremely drug resistant Shigella. So I had him on, and shout out to the CDC. There's some listeners in the audience, and also great to work with. I always respond very quick, and they like doing episodes with me, so I'm always very grateful for that.
Yeah, I mean, let me echo that while we're talking. When I was at the health department in Texas, the Austin Health, so Austin's like the primary public health department in Texas. There are some other regionals in San Antonio and Houston and down in the valley, but Austin's kind of the centralized public health lab. And because of that, they are the laboratory response network. So Austin is where, if we were seeing things, sometimes if hospitals are seeing things, it comes to Austin first, and then we split that sample and it goes to Atlanta for CDC to confirm. So like mpox and all these things you're worried about. But I do want to give my kudos as well. As you may know, I was a visiting scientist at CDC for a couple of stints, primarily for rabies molecular learning. I helped build the regional reference rabies lab in Texas. It's still rocking and rolling. I'm really proud of that. We did that back in kind of the late 90s and up to 2002 before I left. And so I know CDC and the WHO and some of these places are right in the crosshairs these days, but I will go to my grave singing their praises because most of these individuals are dedicated, passionate, intelligent people that are working their tails off for public health. And you know what I always tell people, when you don't hear anything, it doesn't mean that they're not doing anything. It means they're doing their job. It only seems to be when things happen, or maybe there's a hiccup with something that, there's a lot of criticism. But we want a well-functioning, well-staffed public health department at CDC and within the states. Really critical to public health for everyone.
Indeed.
Pretty passionate about that, as you can tell.
Yeah.
It was tough at times during COVID because and some things needed to be criticized and some things needed to be improved, but they are there to help us and to improve public health and make sure you have clean drinking water and just on and on and on. They're doing stuff every day and they often are not seen or recognized. So much like the medical laboratory, they can be a little out of sight. So I just like to give a shout out to them whenever I can.
Definitely. So now maybe let's talk a little bit about the signs and symptoms, and that can and we can also talk a little bit about laboratory findings with that, and maybe is there any tests?
Sure. I might get going here a little bit because there's actually a lot here. And so let me just mention to you and to the audience, there are complete and fantastic algorithms for anyone that's truly in the trenches and concerned about dengue. They should be working with their public health labs and with physicians and really working on this because there are unique circumstances that would take us a while to dive into all these. I'm going to give you kind of the 40,000 foot view, but literally it kind of depends on if you've had a certain genotype and then you come back with a different genotype, and that means you might need specific testing. And so there's a lot going on here with signs and symptoms. But let me kind of give you the overview and then we'll see if we have any questions. But I did want to point out that these resources are excellent. Again, you can find these with CDC and many public health departments. So about one in four dengue infections are symptomatic. So that means sometimes they can be less apparent. And they can be, unfortunately, everything from very mild to severe. And usually symptoms begin after an incubation of about 5 to 7 days, so about a week. It can go from 3 to 10 days. Again, these are all kind of in the median, and present as fever, accompanied by what's known as non-specific signs and symptoms like nausea, vomiting, rash, fatigue, muscle ache, joint pain, bone pain. By the way, you may know the common name of this disease is break bone disease, because supposedly I've never had it, but when you look at case studies, people report how miserable the pain is kind of associated. So long ago, people kind of called it break bone disease. Some pain behind the eyes, migraine-like, headache. And then you can also have really low white blood cell counts. Some of the warning signs are specific clinicals that predict progression to more severe disease. So these warning signs, and this is probably more on the physician side, when you're looking at these, they would include, again, there's a lot here, right? So abdominal pain or tenderness, nonstop vomiting, that would be a problem. Clinical fluid accumulation, which sometimes people know as ascites or pleural effusion, kind of if you've ever seen anybody retaining liquid, sometimes this happens when you're hospital ridden and you're sitting in a bed too long and you can push the skin and it kind of leaves an indention. That's clinical fluid accumulation. Mucosal bleeding, restlessness, or lethargy, an increase of your hematocrit, and a liver enlargement that's greater than 2 centimeters. So those are the warning signs. And then for severe disease with associated severe bleeding, you can also see shock or respiratory types of issues. There's some things they talk about here that get into the weeds, like plasma leakage, organ. You can have some organ impairment. Very few people, so it's like 1 in 20. The problem with this is you can kind of imagine all of these signs and symptoms. Sometimes you're going to need a test pretty quickly and then get really astute physician to kind of figure out what's happening, because you can treat incorrectly and actually harm the patient. This is where it really gets into the weeds, Louise. So I'm going to kind of stay away from that a little bit. The algorithms are literally categorized into how to handle different patients, and it's pretty extensive. So, that would be something that a physician would kind of dive into. Infants, less than 1 year, pregnant people, adults greater than 65, and those with other types of conditions, just like most things we've talked about in the last 5 years, they're going to be higher risk, right? So immunocompromised patients. And interestingly, and I mentioned this early, although a second dengue infection with a different serotype or genotype from the first carries a higher risk of severe disease than a first, third, or fourth infection, which sounds bizarre. And I can talk a little bit about that in a minute, but any one can be severe, but it can also get even dangerous or deadly if there's a second one that's different from the first serotype. It has to do with the antibodies that you developed, and we can kind of talk about that here in a minute when we get to the testing and things. So as you can see, hopefully we didn't put everybody to sleep there, but it's pretty complex. And in the article I wrote, I kept it even less in the weeds, because it's pretty difficult to dive into that unless you're really trying to triage and differentiate patient populations. It even has to deal with, like, if you travel into those endemic areas or not, if you've been vaccinated or not, if you've had an infection or not, or multiple infections. So there's all of these algorithms that a physician has to kind of look at. So I would absolutely, say to you to make sure you go to those documents if this is something you're worried about. For the test, right? So patients with symptoms that are compatible with dengue can be tested with molecular and/or serological test. And so obviously, serological immunological tests are often more passive. They're looking at antibody, things like that. But there are ways that that can be useful. All patients suspected of dengue infections should be tested with a a NAT, a nucleic acid amplification test, a PCR-based test. There's something called an NS1 antigen test, and there's also an IgM, that first or early antibody test, to confirm the dengue infection. So as Louise knows, and many of you know, many hospitals are not going to have this type of algorithm sitting at their desk, maybe a few. But generally, this is probably going to be a special order that gets sent to a reference lab or perhaps a public health lab, and they can kind of go through that process. Really, the test can be considered at any time, but it is important to mention here, like a lot of things, the test sensitivity of the RT-PCR and the antigen test can decrease after the first 7 days. So sooner the better. And goodness, you know, they talk about IgG detection by ELISA in a single serum patient should not be used to diagnose a patient because acute dengue would not distinguish between current and previous. So it kind of goes back to our basic immunology. You kind of want to be careful with IgG tests because that second, you know, later antibody, and it may not mean anything, or it may mean something. Again, you have to kind of understand what's going on with the test. So I'm gonna kind of stop there and just again reiterate that testing, you know, is tied to symptoms and suspicion and travel and signs, and all of that's kind of a collective algorithm that someone's going to be working on with you. And I suspect, Luis, I mean, I have no doubt that if someone has dengue, they're probably pretty sick. And, you know, it hopefully is in the differential of, where do you live? Have you done any travel? Do you remember any mosquito bites? They're going to be collecting that information and then quickly, hopefully, doing some molecular testing so that they can get some answers back to proceed in a proper way. Because it would be pretty, you know, it'd be pretty tricky if you were up in Minnesota and you hadn't traveled anywhere and all of a sudden you have these similar symptoms. It might be something completely different. It could even be influenza for that matter. So, like, you know, sometimes the story, you know, the patient's story and the history is so critical to moving, you know, in the right path for some of these diagnostic tests.
Definitely agree. And for the audience, you know, as you mentioned, and I want to say it again, you know, I'll include a link, as I said, to the article and then to the CDC. Definitely, if you want to get more information, I invite you to check out these resources under, so you can check it out in more detail. You know, with this, it can give you an overview so you can get familiarized with it, you know, have some talking points. But if you really want to dive into it, go to these other places so you can get a lot more information. As you were mentioning, you know, this is something, it's interesting because when we started talking about it, it popped in my mind, but you talked about the breakbones. And I remember the Spanish term for it.
Okay.
Yeah, like it's rompehuesos, which is, you know, breakbones. And I used to remember that every now and then you will hear, hey, you know, so-and-so had the rompehuesos, you know.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
It just came to mind.
How old were you when you left Puerto Rico?
I was about to turn 19.
Okay, so you were there. You would definitely remember some of this. You weren't like a child that was leaving when you were really young.
No. And I, when I'd done some interviews here and there, like I kind of touched on it, but yeah, I did all the way through high school and then I started in college. And then at the time I wasn't fully mature yet. So I wasn't appreciating that experience. So I joined the Navy and I grew up. I'm mature.
Yeah. Okay, cool. I didn't know that. That's cool. Thank you for your service. That's pretty awesome. But, you know, it's interesting to hear that, right? To get to know that from you, because I often tell students, right? So I teach at Texas State University in the MLS program, and I also teach as an adjunct at Austin Community College in Austin. Been doing that. I'm starting my 29th year, if you can believe that. And many, many students that I teach are international. And I can remember, you might appreciate this, Louise, 30 years ago when I kind of started as an adjunct. I started as an adjunct at Austin Community College when I was working at the health department. And, you know, I came in there, you know, mid-20s. I knew everything, or I thought I did. And I can remember talking about things like malaria or other diseases like this. And, you know, I'd kind of, to your point, I was probably that public service announcement that you were talking about. I really kind of harped on the dangers and the deadliness of it. And I'll never forget a couple of young ladies that had just came to the US from that world. And they said, you know, they're very polite. And they said, you know, Dr. Rohde, in Africa, malaria is kind of like the common cold or the flu. We get it all the time. And it is dangerous and people can die, but in general, they don't. And we just kind of deal with it. And I was like, I was just floored, like, oh my God, like this is like they're from the places I'm talking about. And it was really an aha moment for me as a professor and a human being to kind of think about how I sometimes talked about disease and infection because, you know, we not all of us experience the real world scenario of that. And so that's another reason I really love to travel, as we kind of started off with, is to try to get some perspective sometimes because many Americans need to travel more. Many people need to travel more just to kind of get that feel for all sorts of topics. So it's good to know you had that experience. I didn't know that about you. It's cool.
Thank you. So I want to ask right now about a prevention and treatment, and I want to talk about the vaccine, but that on a separate question. But as far as right, so we definitely, you know, we talked about the awareness, you know, knowing where you're going, and that applies to, you know, any other diseases, and definitely, you know, with a mosquito, right, try to eliminate some of those breeding grounds for them. What can we talk as far as, you know, what can we do as far as prevention and treatment?
Yeah, great question. So again, leaning on my public health roots, this is right in my wheelhouse. We used to do this. So I mean, the obvious here, which sounds silly, but it's obvious, you do want to kind of avoid mosquito bites and tick bites and, you know, other types of vectors. You want to be careful. Now, that can be tough depending on where you're at, but you certainly want to be aware. Maybe you're traveling somewhere. You know, there's definitely a higher risk in some of these places versus, you know, again, Minnesota. Just because of where you're at. So that equatorial belt and below, when you get into tropical and subtropical regions, we often talk about neglected tropical diseases that are pretty impactful, but a lot of people don't think about in America because they're not here all the time. And so you don't think about them. You travel and all of a sudden you got malaria. So it's something to think about. And then you brought up you know, some of the other things. So it's important from a public health standpoint. Is many times you might be advised to use DEET-based insect repellents, wear long sleeves, long pants. You know, if you're in certain countries and there's no air conditioning, you might be asked to sleep with netting to help prevent mosquitoes. Again, something you would never think about here because most people are indoors. We do have some that are not, unfortunately, with homeless and things like that. So it is something to think about in that patient presentation if people are living outdoors or traveling outdoors. And so all of that's kind of the prevention piece. The other part that I think is kind of important to remind people is that again, when you are beginning to think about travel, you know, even if you're talking to your primary care physician. Let's say you don't have a primary care physician, or for whatever reason, there's nothing that says you can't, I mean, do a quick look at a public health department or do a search for this type of information. In today's world, you can find pretty good information, education, public health education in those types of realms. But yeah, just I think it's really important, and a lot of people don't think about it when they're traveling or doing things. The reason this is so important, Luis, for dengue, and you know this from your background, is there are actually no antiviral medications that I'm aware of to treat dengue. I mean, there might be some experimental ones out there, but nothing that I'm aware of that's FDA approved. So it's really supportive, and kind of they call it volume management because there's something to do with that fluid issue, depending on what's going on. You have to kind of watch that. And so I kind of dug up some of this just for your readers, but basically it's about the appropriate triage and diagnostics. That's really critical. And then managing the infection and then kind of following up to make sure that the patient's responding and not having any complications. And if you have someone that's at really high risk for severe disease, then the WHO has something called the rapid initiation of a standardized fluid replacement strategy. And the WHO has a whole document on this, and it supposedly, well, it does, they have it there documented, that it can decrease mortality from about 13% down to about 1. So almost a complete log of mortality reduction. Again, this is really severe cases, really, really dangerous cases, but those are the types of cases that hopefully people are getting that type of support. I suspect that it's difficult if you're in certain places and you don't have the means to get all of this help, but there is some available help if the case becomes really severe.
And now, so, and this is in your article, and I read a little bit about it, and I wanted to ask you, so, you know, you mentioned there's a vaccine, but then it's also being discontinued, right? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I did some more digging on this when we talked about doing the podcast, because I kind of wanted to gain even a deeper understanding. So I'm just going to kind of give you kind of what I have found in most available sources. So in June of 2021, something called ACIP, this is something in the U.S., it's the Advisory Committee of Immunization Practices. These are the people, experts that get together and make recommendations for approved vaccines and things like that. In June of 2021, they recommended a dengue vaccine. It's called Dengvaxia, D-E-N-G-V-A-X-I-A, Dengvaxia. I think I'm pronouncing it correctly. And for children, they only recommended this for children aged 9 to 16 years, with laboratory confirmation of a previous dengue infection and living in areas with frequent or continuous dengue transmission like Puerto Rico. And the next kind of information was kind of interesting. It said, while the vaccine is considered safe and pretty effective, the manufacturer Sanofi Pasteur out of Paris, France, has discontinued production, citing a lack of demand. And so right now, vaccine administration is continuing in Puerto Rico until available doses expire. They believe it will happen sometime in 2026, so year and 4 months or so. And there are no vaccines right now recommended for travelers, adults, or persons without a previous dengue infection. So what's going on there? One of the things that I thought I would maybe mention to you is, if you have a little bit of time, it's kind of interesting. So as we mentioned, dengue is kind of an acute fever-borne illness caused by one of these four related serotypes. So again, remember there's four, and the severity of the infection kind of varies depending on which serotype and whether it's a first or subsequent infection. And so I kind of broke this down a little bit for my own brain. So let's say you get a first infection. So infection with one serotype usually will provide long-term immunity to that virus, but only short-lived protection against the other three serotypes. So that means you can actually have severe dengue infection during a first infection, but it can be even greater with a second infection. So that's the first. What happens with a second infection? So here's kind of a scenario for your audience. A second infection with a different serotype is known as a secondary or heterotypic infection, and that can lead to a condition we call antibody-dependent enhancement, ADE. And this occurs when pre-existing antibodies from the one serotype bind to the virus particles from the new serotype, but they fail to neutralize the infection, and that actually makes the clinical symptoms of dengue worse, which increases the risk of severe dengue. To add another little nuance to that, so the vaccine, which again could be considered relevant and useful in a certain age group, it kind of depends on what you kind of saw there. So like one of the reasons they don't want to give it to Americans who are traveling is because if you build up antibodies and you travel and get an infection, even though it's your first infection, you're going to already have antibodies, and it may not neutralize the way you think it's going to neutralize, and it could actually be a really severe infection. And I'm thinking, I couldn't really dig this out, but I'm thinking if you live in Puerto Rico or you live in Brazil or somewhere, maybe they don't give it to children because they want them to have an infection in a sense so that they have had that exposure and then they give it to them to help protect them from a second infection, if that makes sense, because this, it's pretty complicated. It's kind of unusual. I don't know if I've seen, in all honesty, Luis, and maybe you've heard of any, I haven't really seen or come across anything in my understanding or learning that is so complicated with subsequent infections. There are some other viruses and infections that do weird things, but really bizarre and kind of complicated with those four genotypes that it causes so many nuances. And you can see how this could be problematic with testing and treatment and vaccine recommendations and physicians trying to figure things out. So just to really, again, I'll say it forever. Viruses are some of the most interesting pathogens on Earth, but they're also some of the most diabolically nasty things. They just outthink our immune system and do weird things when we least expect it. I guess it's why I love virology so much. It's just so unique, and your body's constantly trying to evolve with the virus. Just really difficult to do.
Definitely, well said. Dr. Brody, I want to ask you something about that is not related to dengue, but before I do that, I wanted to ask you, is there anything else that you want to add about this for the audience?
Yeah, I think we've kind of covered most of it, but I would just throw out there for your audience and really anyone that's thinking about these things that are kind of ongoing in our last decade, is that I think, my professional opinion anyway is that we're going to continue to see geographic expansion of these types of infections. And that's really because our vector expansion's occurring, weather changes, weather patterns, climate, however you want to think about it, world travel. It's really easy to get around the world. All of these things are creating new spaces and new opportunities for vectors to thrive and find new niches to live in and hitchhike across the world. And I'd really encourage everyone to think about it's become kind of a catchphrase, but it is important to understand that a one health approach is really important. And that means looking at not just human health, but animal health and environmental health, and how that interplay creates a one health approach. And I hope one of the lessons we've learned post-COVID, and even we're still dealing with COVID, obviously, but as we continue to wind away from COVID and deal with other things, that the public across the world really understands how critical it is to have surveillance, funding for surveillance and testing and accurate diagnostics and vaccines and prevention and education. And it's really not something that we can, this is something I've seen, right? I've been around long enough now. I've worked for three good decades. And everyone I've lived through, West Nile, Zika, influenza, anthrax, on and on and on, mpox, COVID, whatever we've lived through, unfortunately, we tend to knee-jerk in the US. That's been my experience. Like we knee-jerk, we get lots of money thrown at the HIV. Lots of money thrown at something, and maybe we get better with it and we do okay. And then we kind of sit on our haunches a little bit and we don't continuously sustain public health of funding and even for professionals, right? We talk a lot about medical lab workforce shortages, but it's just as bad in the public health laboratories. And so I'm on a soapbox a little bit, but I think it's really critical that we as a country think about that. Because we're only going to see, I think, more things like antibiotic resistance, antimicrobial resistance. That's a pandemic all in of itself that we don't really think about. It's kind of a slow-burning pandemic, right? It just continues to march on. So we need to get ready and we need to be prepared.
Yes, definitely. And I was talking to someone in another podcast, and you mentioned AMR. I'm just going to briefly touch on this, but yeah, you definitely see, and those of us that work in the bench, and we're seeing those results come in, and we're seeing all these profiles with all this resistance, and it has increased so much over the years.
It's scary. It's pretty scary, right? I mean, I'm 57 years old, and I can remember, I can remember being relatively young, but old enough to understand that diseases like diphtheria and, meningitis and polio and other infections like strep throat. Simple things that we think we can treat, we're not as effective anymore. And some of them have become, as you know, Luis, very dangerous. Almost to the point now where, we're down to our last antibiotic or our last antimicrobial. And that's kind of frightening to think about the future. Hopefully we can do something about that with a collective global effort. But I continue to state, and I know you know this, but I continue to believe that AMR is at the top of our list of concerns. I mean, we're always going to have to watch out for that novel virus or, influenza, on and on and on. We have to keep our guard up. But AMR is kind of stealth, and it continues to make advancements, and it's something that really concerns me, especially for my children and grandchildren and things like that, because there's some nasty organisms out there, and if we lose our control of antibiotics over something as simple as Streptococcus or Klebsiella or any of the others that we worry about, Shigella, what have you, we're in trouble because those, as you know, are much more prevalent in higher incidence when you kind of look around the world. We have way more infections from those than we do, SARS-CoV-2 or something like that. So hopefully we can globally, tackle that as we move forward.
Definitely. As we are closing, one of the things, those of you in the audience that that you're familiar with Dr. Rohde, he's very active. He publishes, he does talks, he's been in different podcasts, I guess, and talks, but now are you hosting a podcast? Can you maybe talk more about that?
Yeah, thank you so much for giving me that opportunity to help publicize it with your audience. So yes, I am very excited and very honored that Contagion Live gave me the opportunity to become a host of my own podcast. If you're not familiar with Contagion Live, they are just a great area for more information around all things pathogens as well as some other topics. And for many mere for about 2 years or so, I was writing articles for them and doing the occasional interview and things like that. And then John Parkinson asked me if I'd like to host my own podcast. And like you, I've watched you grow yours, and I've got other friends that are doing. I've always kind of hesitated because with my different hats at the university, and to be honest with you, I want to do it right. And so I applaud you for everything you've done because for me, I'm always worried about the technical side. Like I know I can handle the expertise and the bringing in great guests and doing that sort of thing. But I want to make sure that, I guess the marketing behind it and the things like that are good and solid. And so I didn't really have the time to think about worrying about that, to be honest. And then, so when he reached out and said, "Hey, we'll do all that. We'll kind of handle all the backside of it with all the right technology and making sure we market it correctly." And so, once he made that commitment and Contagion Live asked me, I was super excited, very honored. And so, the podcast is, it's actually called, it's kind of a long name, but it's called From Pathogen to Infectious Disease Diagnosis. Taking on potential standard of care diagnostic opportunities. So the idea behind it is actually to talk with different experts in the field, much like you do, but try to bring that interplay between the medical laboratory and sometimes public health laboratory and the physician, healthcare provider side. And as you know, kind of get into that space of medical lab scientist and DCLSs and diagnostic management teams. I'm pretty passionate about that. As you know, I think people like you and other medical lab professionals that are in the trenches should be consulting with physicians and others, pharmacists and others, to help improve diagnostic stewardship, the right test, interpretation of the right test, so that we save money, save lives, more efficient. Less hospital stay time, all of those things. So that's kind of our topic. And my first interview was with Dr. Michael LaPasada, who's kind of the father of diagnostic management teams. I'm about to do my second one shortly, with a DCLS professional that I met at ASCLS. She did a talk on fungal meningitis. So I'll be, you'll see me if you check me out. I'm kind of in working in that realm, but it might bleed into some of the areas you're doing too, where I just purely talk to, you know, an infectious disease expert or somebody about a particular topic. But I'm going to try to also dip into that area about how we're helping physicians and others make accurate diagnoses. So I'm excited about it. Thanks for letting me share that.
Yeah, of course, my pleasure. And is this like, as far as you know, available on all different platforms, or if they can go to like to?
Yeah, it's available in all different platforms. If you look up Contagion Live and, you know, search for that podcast, you can find me. I can send you that link if you'd like. If you want to share it, that'd be great. But it comes out, you know, in the various platforms that you can listen to podcasts in. So it's pretty easily listened to.
Perfect. Yeah. So if you can send I'll put it on the show notes. You know, as you said, that if someone is handling the editing and the marketing, it definitely it makes it a lot easier, because yeah, I almost have like a full time job doing this. Yeah.
I bet. I mean, I applaud you, man. I applaud you. I just try to think about the time and, you know, this is one thing to do the interview and to talk. It's the stuff before and after, I think, that people don't realize. Like in many cases, they don't realize the work that goes on behind the scenes. And so it, you know, I needed that support because of I'm sure you could use it too, you know, but I definitely needed it for my roles, because I just had too much on my plate as a chair and a professor and adjunct professor and the other things that I'm doing. So this allows me to do something I love. And again, I cannot thank Contagion Live enough for giving me that opportunity and making it happen.
Definitely. Well, you know, Dr. Brody, as always, you know, it's a pleasure. And this was so informative. And I put in the article, you know, those articles, they explain things so well, and they're always very helpful. So thank you for your work, and always, you know, thank you for always saying yes and taking the time to be here. And Let's Talk Micro.
Absolutely. And thank you. Thank you for reaching out. I always appreciate the invitation. It's especially nice to kind of amplify the articles or amplify the message, whatever that is. So if I can ever be of any assistance, please reach out. I'd be happy to chat with you. Maybe I'll have you on my podcast sometime, and we can talk to you about your experiences as an educator in the trenches MLS and a podcast host. That would be kind of fun.
Definitely. It will be my pleasure.
All right, Chief. Thanks a lot.
And that, my dear audience, it's the end of this episode. I hope you enjoy learning about the dengue virus. As always, I enjoy sharing this information with you. Thank you so much for the support. Thank you for listening, for downloading, for sharing episodes. I am so grateful. And thank you, Dr. Brody, for taking the time. So stay tuned. Great things coming your way. So as always, continue bringing that passion to what you do. It's so important. You do such great work. So, as always, stay motivated, stay safe, and of course, continue talking micro. Until the next time. Bye.